Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. The nonprofit sector has grown by roughly 25%, says our next guest, and given away some $316 billion. All while inequality has grown and some 9.4 million people remain unemployed. It's part of the effects of what he calls the charitable industrial complex that may merely be perpetuating global poverty. Peter Buffett joins us. He's an Emmy Award-winning musician, composer, author of the book Life is What You Make It, and a philanthropist. He co-chairs the Novo Foundation, one of three foundations that is funded by his father, Warren Buffett. Welcome, Peter Buffett.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Let's start with this idea that you wrote about in the New York Times called philanthropic colonialism. What exactly do you mean by this?
Well, I'm going to start by saying I'm completely intimidated by the name Scholar Circle. I'm no scholar, but I'll do my best. And, you know, it's interesting in a way because that framework, the colonialist framework for me started when I was involved with the American Indian culture and learned all sorts of things historically about our country that I never learned in school. So I got sensitive to the idea of a culture coming in to another framework that they didn't know or understand or want to learn about, and essentially in the case of America, you know, try and just completely get it out of the way. And so in a much milder form, I started to hear stories around philanthropic work, and in fact was guilty of it myself, you know, where somebody would think, oh my gosh, well, this sounds like this would be the perfect answer to that particular problem. Coming from the outside, having no real clue to the intricacies and nuances on the ground. And so I guess coined the term philanthropic colonialism. And of course, all the people on the ground jump up and down in glee when they hear a funder say that, because they know firsthand what happens when somebody, specifically, of course, with money, comes into a place to say, I'll solve your problem for you.
So what are some examples of the unintended consequences of this particular phenomenon you're talking about?
You know, I cite one in the op-ed, which is interesting because it's fascinating to read the criticism around that. But, you know, there was a very well-meaning attempt to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS in part of India. I think it was Calcutta in particular in this case. And, you know, the idea was a lot of it gets spread through the brothels and through the red light districts, and that I'm sure is very true. So there was the idea of making sure condom use was widespread by distributing them, at least, you know, the hope that it would be used, and I'm sure there was training and all sorts of things. And the first real underlying problem that I didn't mention that does is it legitimizes brothels and red light areas. It says, okay, we're just going to make them better. And if you spend any time with girls that have been trafficked into these areas, the last thing you want to do is legitimize it. So there's that layer of it. And then the next layer is, in fact, the shifting pricing structure because of it. And the girls will get paid more if they have unprotected sex. Now, some people say, well, that must mean there's, you know, still more protected sex, and isn't that better because they're getting more money? And it's like, not really. It's a much larger problem than that. And yes, that might be a little bit of a consequence, but again, the larger point is it's legitimizing the practice and putting these girls in even a more complex situation that is not of their preference in the least. And so that's one example.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting was this kind of juxtaposition of you getting to sit in on some of these conversations that you witnessed because of your dad,
right?
And seeing the left hand creating the problem and the right hand trying to solve the problem. And you left it a little bit vague as to who was trying to solve the problem, who was creating the problem, even though I think, you know, most of us kind of have a sense of who you're talking
right,
about.
Exactly. Yeah.
But for those who don't quite understand what you meant by that, who was in the room?
And that's the thing, is that I remind everyone that the emperor has no clothes story was not about shaming the emperor. It was about saying what was obvious. And so it's true, you know, that there's this tendency to say tell me more. The truth is, and this is the complexity of the world we live in today, is when you're in the room with any entity that is a global corporate enterprise, of which, you know, they're the ones with the most money, and therefore they are at these larger gatherings, and in fact they are sitting with heads of state, and these are well-meaning people. You know, that's the other part that's often left out, and it was actually in the op-ed at one point and got edited out, that these are well-meaning people. This is, no one's doing this on purpose, but you've got, you know, shareholder value and quarterly returns and the drive to do things most efficiently as you can for all those reasons happening on the one hand. And so that means that you might be degrading the environment. You might be offering lower wages. And so there's poverty and hunger and all the things that go with that. There's a host of issues that accompany any corporation that is publicly held that is trying to serve its shareholders the best it can, while on the other hand, it is creating often, you know, not always, issues on the other side of the globe around wages and environmental issues and health issues and all sorts of things. And so then when the foundation side of this particular company, or a foundation that has its corpus invested in these companies, you know, that's another whole layer to this, is that it might be a foundation head, very well-meaning, doing the best they can. Meanwhile, they're making money to do good by investing the very dollars in a corporation that is undermining them in the very work they're trying to help solve or make better. So there's these various layers where the one hand, in fact, is creating the issue that the other hand is trying to solve or make better in some way.
And never mind that all of our pensions are connected as well into these very problem-making systems.
Well, that's the thing, is it's so inextricably linked. I mean, you can look at the simple version, and again, I am not a scholar, so I'm sure every example I cite, someone, that's what I've noticed with the op-ed, is that people can get in there and go, well, what about this? But the truth is, you know, people are clamoring for jobs, understandably, and at the same time insisting at their local Target or Walmart or whatever it might be for lowest prices. Well, those are inextricably linked, and you're going to end up with jobs going overseas and creating other problems because of that to get the lower prices, which then put people out of jobs. I mean, it just keeps going around and around.
And you noted in your op-ed piece that while inequality is rising, the nonprofit sector is growing.
Correct. And people have pointed out that again, no more than I do, that in fact it stayed about 2% of GDP since the 70s. But it still is true that there's more and more affinity groups and gatherings, and it's definitely talked about a lot more and practiced, I think, quite a bit more by high-profile people than it was in the 70s, for sure. I mean, there's a whole different kind of lens on philanthropy today than there ever was 20 or 30 years ago or more.
You've said that in a way, this is another phrase that you coined, conscience laundering, that
right.
Keeps this system in place, and it just perpetuates the injustice.
I think it really does, because again, I think people thought, and rightly so, if you just look on the surface of the piece, that I was indicting, you know, philanthropy as this awful thing. And what I'm really saying is, again, first of all, they're very much well-meaning people, and that it is part of a systemic problem. You know, it somehow doesn't get a pass because it's doing good things. I'm not saying it's the problem. I'm saying that there's a lot of symptoms, actually, that show up because systemically there's something, I think, deeply flawed in what's going on right now.
How many of those kind of meetings did it actually take for this to dawn on you?
Oh, that's a great question, because we have been working in the philanthropic world at the scale we have for the last 7 years. And for instance, the philanthropic colonialism verbiage came out early on, like within the first year or so, I started saying that. And then you start piecing the puzzle together by going places, experiencing things, obviously, talking to more people. And, you know, there were We don't really go to too many every year, and there's plenty of value, by the way, in going to some of these. I mean, I went to the first Clinton Global Initiative in 2005 and learned a ton, and it was life-changing in some ways in terms of our focus. So there's value as well as, you know, the starting to observe the complexity of the whole thing. But it was over the 7 years, and then finally it all kind of clicked this year.
I think you titled the piece The Charitable Industrial Complex.
Right, exactly, because it's just, and it's funny because somebody was criticizing me about, well, not technically because of this or that, and it's like, that's not the point.
Exactly, yeah.
With 800 words, you can only go so far.
Some of the means that some of these charities are approaching, what they think will create sustainable economies, like microlending, financial literacy, might just be what you said, feeding the beast. Do you think that it is?
It can be. I think that some of the microlending practices and the idea that let's just get people into our economy is very destructive. I mean, it's interesting how a lot of people will say, and this makes a lot of sense on the surface, we got to get people living on more than $2 a day. Well, who wouldn't agree with that? Except I would actually flip that on its head and say we should all get closer to living on $2 a day. And that's, of course, extreme. But the idea is that it's not about, you know, pulling people into this economy that sort of, again, is sort of, you know, the snake eating its tail or something. We should think about how do we all get back to, really, because it's all very old thinking, a more community-based, decentralized relationship economy that is fundamentally very different than what we're looking at today. I mean, I do not understand why anybody needs tens of millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in multiple houses and boats and all this crazy stuff, while on the other side of the street or the planet, there are people that, you know, we now actually see. You know, when I was a kid, it was, you know, finish your dinner, there's someone starving in India or something. Well, now, you know what, we see these people, and they're real, and they have stories, and, you know, this is no longer something we can sort of put under the rug.
Your dad, who is one of the most successful, if not the most successful investor, who has made
billions of dollars.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
Have you talked with him about this? What is his response?
Well, in terms of the piece itself, he loved it because we come from a family that, you know, I was a kid during the 60s in the civil rights movement, and my parents were both active and involved and deeply caring people. And in fact, my dad knew then, when he was much younger and didn't have the kind of money he had, that he had a particular talent that would probably make him a lot of money. That was an understatement, but that's what he certainly knew that early on. And knew that it should just go right back into the world that helped him do what he loved every day, you know, because for him it's not, gee, look at all this money, now I can buy all this stuff. It's like, wow, I love going to the office 6 days a week, doing what I do. All this money seems to be piling up. I want to give it away when I'm done to the society that gave me this great gift of doing what I love.
And he has been doing that. As you
yeah.
said, he set up these foundations and he's donating his money in very large chunks back to society. And he pays his staff very well.
Yeah, no, he's a fair guy, you know, and he's again, you know, the people that say, well, he just doesn't want to pay taxes. You know, even if he had to pay whatever rate on it, he'd still do the same thing. It's the gesture again of saying, look, I am so fortunate that I was able to do what I love every day. This society allowed that. This society gets the money back. It's pretty simple.
Let's move to your own foundation and link it into one of the directions that you were trying to go in with your op-ed piece. You said, I don't know that I'm really calling for an end to capitalism itself. I'm calling for humanism. But given the structures, these things that you've noticed and I've noticed as a political scientist of modern-day capitalism, how can humanism be infused when it's part of the legal structure itself?
Well, that's a great question. And in fact, I will tell you the truth. I didn't want to get into the economic structure debate within the op-ed because, you know, I knew that there could be one, and I think there should be one. But I wanted to again, bring it around to let's go from transactions to relationships. You know, we have lost that over the past 40, 50 years, 100 years. You know, this is, all of this stuff is new, which I want to remind everybody. You know, the problems may be relatively old in some ways, but nation states are only a couple hundred years old. I mean, this is all new stuff. And so we're, you know, we're learning as we go. And instead of drawing fire, you know, by saying specifically this is a flawed structure, I'd rather say this is a systemic problem. Let's look at various pieces to the puzzle and find an answer that results in, again, relationships, humanism, you know, putting the person first before the best return on investment, essentially.
A quick reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Peter Buffett about what he calls the charitable industrial complex and conscience laundering. Let's move then to the Novo Foundation that you are co-chair of and what it is that you're trying to do with that. I looked at your mission statement. It's quite profound, really, to foster transformation from a world of domination and exploitation to one of collaboration and partnership.
Well, yeah.
It's a big vision.
If you're going to do it, you might as well go for it as far as we're concerned. And Jennifer and I both, Jennifer's my wife, Jennifer and I both really thought, you know, and again, this comes from the work in the American Indian culture. It comes from other things we've seen and done in our lives that ultimately we got to get back to knowing our neighbor, knowing ourselves, knowing our community. How do we do that? Because what I've found is that, you know, if you look somebody in the eye, you start to have a different feeling about things than if, again, they're under the rug or non-existent. And if you knew who your banker was, if you knew who your farmer was, if you knew where these things came from and had relationships, which, again, has been going on for thousands of years, I think we'd have a different world today, basically. I think we'd have something where there hopefully was no need for charity, frankly, that the root word of philanthropy, which is the love of people, is really what we're going for. So we figured, why not hang that out on our shingle?
And let's talk about some of the ways that you're doing that. One is you've got a focus on women and girls in particular. First of all, what drew you to focus on women and girls, and what are you doing to support their development and potential?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, only a girl will be the mother of every child. No one's argued with me on that point yet. And so, in fact, when you do support a girl in terms of health and education and all these, you know, possible ways she can live into her best self, you're going to support a whole next generation, boys or girls, because it really isn't ultimately about one gender or the other. It's about everybody. But a girl is a faster way to get there. It's a more efficient way to get there. I mean, now I will get all the return on investment people, you know, mad at me, because in that sense, it is a good return on investment. If you're going to support a girl, you know, you look in the aid world, the development world, and where the dollars are deployed. When they are, and they rarely are, deployed to a young girl or, you know, a young woman, it will stay in the family, in the community. It just has a different outcome generally than it does if you give it to an institution or to a man, frankly. I mean, it's pretty simple in that regard. And so you add the efficiency with the fact that she's going to be the mom and it's going to stay in the community, and you get a better result.
And you also said that there are people showing examples of these other ways to live, these other kinds of communities that truly create greater prosperity for all. What are some examples?
Well, that's where we're trying to seed, and that's a key word or concept, really. We're only trying to create conditions for change. We're not sure how change is going to come, and we're not going to try and define what it looks like, but we are going to try and create conditions. So we work with various projects around local living economies, which is also on the website, and ways to, again, foster a shift back to, you know, kind of this decentralized, more relationship literal economy in terms of people that are working on different frameworks around the money system. And again, this is mostly old stuff, just renewed in terms of how communities can be more resilient And of course, the collapse in 2008 helped us. That was in our favor, sadly, you know, but in a good way. It made everybody look at their neighbor and go, uh-oh, maybe this is where I should focus, because my money in a bank that doesn't know me, or, you know, my food from a farm that I'll never see, or, you know, these various components to my life that are the lifeblood, really, of my daily existence, I don't even know who these people are or where they are, and they certainly don't know me.
You've mostly spent your life being a musician and a songwriter, and now you're also an author. And your message in the title of your book, Life is What You Make It, which is great, but I wonder, from the title, I was wondering if maybe it masks the structural and systemic realities that you're criticizing.
It's interesting because, of course, the first sentence after someone sees life is what you make it and sees my last name is easy for you to say. And that's the thing I dispel right away, whether it's live in my show or in the book or anything else, because what I'm really trying to do is reframe or rediscover the real meaning of words. And the first one is probably privilege or wealth or success or, you know, one of those. And I then go into telling my story, which is I grew up in Omaha and I walked to public school and I had the same English teacher my mother had, and, you know, all these things where privilege was growing up in a neighborhood where people knew you and loved you and nurtured you and made you feel safe. So it's really trying to get back to that as what makes us whole, as opposed to the mythology around certainly who my dad is and then who I must be, where it's all about the money and isn't it great to be rich? You know, I joke about the fact that I only recently became Warren Buffett's son. Nobody really cared, frankly, or knew, and that's great. You know, that allowed me to live my life, and, you know, without my dad's help in terms of financial stability or something, you know, I talk about how self-respect comes from earning your own reward. You know, if I had a dad that wrote me a check every time I fell down, I wouldn't know how to get up. So it's really a book and a message around essentially redefining certain concepts around what privilege really is, and, you know, that it's all about figuring it out yourself as opposed to somebody doing it for you, essentially.
Yet, of course, when you talk about the systemic issues, people who don't grow up in the safe neighborhood or people
right.
who don't grow up with that sense of safety and community and are exploited would struggle with that.
Absolutely. And that's actually, I wrote a blog about that because I sat down with some girls who were sold into sex trafficking early on. And I said, how do you say life is what you make it to somebody like that? And you don't. You know, you listen and you learn and you're trying to figure out how to shift systemically what's going on in whatever way one can. You know, my wife and I are fortunate that we might be able to do things. Certainly others can't, but you never know where it could come from. But there are way too many people that can't say, you know, life is what I make it. There's no question about that. And so I am definitely addressing mostly people with money, you know, kids, regardless, at the university level. I do a lot of shows there. And the whole idea is do what you can with what you've got to make this world more equitable for all, no question.
So where are you on your conversation and music tour now?
Well, I have been doing it a little bit before the book came out. It came out in 2010, and then it's been pretty much a full-time job since then. I mean, I just lied. It's not a full-time job because the foundation is also a full-time job. And so, you know, I'm doing both, and they're sort of interrelated in kind of a curious way, but or they have continued to find common ground in a lot of ways. But I have gone to China now probably 9 times in the last couple of years. The book is a runaway hit in China, and which is probably a topic for another show. But I am very busy out on the road, again, mostly either colleges, community foundations, kind of family wealth management organizations, you know, that sort of thing. So it's an interesting mix of demographic, I guess, out there with the show. And the fun thing about the show, it's called A Concert in Conversation, and I actually take questions through the whole show. Anybody can ask me anything at any time. And That's probably the most fun part for me. So, you know, this is part of how I make a living. You know, I don't take a salary from the foundation. And in fact, I've been a musician all my life and written music for commercials and film and all this stuff. And this is now my livelihood.
We appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I've been, you know, not responding to everything because, you know, again, people kind of want to draw you in and down into the polarizing debate around good and bad or this or that. And I'm trying to keep the conversation up a notch, you know, to just say, this is what I see. Others seem to be seeing it too. And how do we do something about it?
I think that's the kind of questions that need to be asked and need to be broadcast in the public sphere, as they call it. Unfortunately, yeah. Not enough do it.
Yeah, no, somebody kind of criticized me on this idea of writing new code. And what do you mean by new code? And I said, well, Thomas Jefferson wrote new code. You know, I mean, this is not, it's probably something that needs to be done occasionally, and it might be time.
Well, language has a profound effect on reality.
It sure does. It is the skin of culture, as someone once said. And I do think that language and the way we use it has a almost insidious way of kind of taking us towards something that maybe we didn't actually mean. And language is critical to how we move forward. And again, that's why I'm trying to redefine some of the words we use.
And because you're a songwriter and a poet, I think that you're able to do this in a way that maybe a straight business person doesn't.
Well, that's what I'm hoping, is that because I have this different vantage point, you know, partly, of course, because of who my dad is, but also equally so, if not more so, because of what I've been doing all my life, I'm not steeped in it quite like somebody else is. You know, I love to say that, you know, once you start consuming culture, culture starts to consume you. And so if the further you can stay a little bit outside of it to observe it, I think the better in terms of trying to get across some of these ideas that need to be spoken about.
Well, I hope we can continue the conversation at a later date.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye.